rather than look at our lifestyle, you know, we drive our cars too much. The oil is going onto the roads. It's, you know, it's changing it. We cut down too many forests. We put up too many dams. Rather than deal with all this, we think that hatcheries, or we have thought in the past that hatcheries are the way. Now, this is getting back to the four H's that you talked about. And in the book, what I think is beautiful, the amount of research is amazing. And you talk about how, you know, the first people who were discovering this scientific process of doing hatchery. And was this in Scotland, I believe, or England?
Yeah, well, actually, there was a guy in Germany who in the late 18th century, and his name is escaping me at the moment, but he was an officer, I think, in the Prussian Guard, Jacob, I think. He essentially rediscovered the art of trout and salmon hatching by taking eggs from adult fish, putting them in boxes, nurturing them, and then putting the young fish back in the rivers. He did it as really an academic experiment, and everyone forgot about it again until about the 1820s or 30s, when a guy named Shaw in Scotland, and then a few other of his Shaw's contemporaries, started to try and nurture fish in hatcheries because the Scottish salmon were viewed to be sort of alarmingly on a trajectory towards lower and lower numbers, and they were a major economic factor at the time. So there's sort of an attempt to try and prop up the English fisheries by using this the idea of hatchery production that the German gentleman rediscovered.
Yeah, you know, so when we think of our society with cars and all that, no, not necessarily, because you can still destroy salmon without even having any. I mean, hundreds of years before there were cars, they were decimating salmon runs.
Yeah.
And you talk about King George IV, was it? The big deal about him eating the last salmon.
One of the stories about the extirpation of the Thames River salmon, which was one of the first salmon runs in the English-speaking world with a focused effort to save them that Queen Anne started in the 1712, they were extinct by the 1830s. And one of the stories about what happened to the last one is that King George IV ate it after paying an astronomical price, a guinea a pound, for purchasing it.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the efforts to legislate, quote-unquote, solutions to the salmon problem, going back 300 years.
Yeah, well, there's even laws to protect salmon that go back much longer. The earliest one I can trace goes back before the Norman invasion of England to, I think it was 1030 in the realm of King Malcolm II of Scotland, where he passed a law, although in that day a law was essentially an edict from the king, that said you could not fish for salmon once they made it back to the river to spawn. They knew very well that you had to protect spawning salmon in order to have juvenile salmon go back out to the sea and come back as the next generation. And there's a whole series of laws in ancient Scotland and England designed to protect salmon runs, to bar the damming of rivers in ways that would prevent salmon from running up and down the rivers, and to bar poaching, and to prevent habitat degradation, although it was usually in the form of literally blocking salmon from going up and downstream. The habitat quality understanding part of the whole story is a more recent development. But so that the efforts, formal legislative efforts to protect salmon, go back a long way.
Yeah, and for some reason, what was it? Was it the cutting down the trees to make ships? Was that the main thing, and the resulting loss in habitat for salmon in England specifically?
Actually, a big part of it was the development of the Industrial Revolution. A lot of salmon channels were places where you could get water power very easily. Sort of small, steep streams where you could put a mill wheel on it and you could power your factory. And the very first modern factory was a silk mill, I believe it was, in England, was right on a salmon stream. And the economic interests that were driving those changes were interested in harnessing the power, not letting the fish get past. And so salmon didn't really have a constituency other than sort of an abstract one downstream, the fishermen who really, really wanted to preserve the runs. There's wonderful descriptions of how Parliament, every year from probably about the 1810s, 1820s to the 1840s or 50s, measures would be introduced to do something about the declining state of the salmon fisheries, but there was always a legislative stalemate, and little ever got done.
Yeah, and so what happens is, and we see it in this country, and we see it through the whole history of that, it's that no one sort of superficial solution is going to handle it. Initiative 77 in the state of Washington, all it did basically was, instead of one group being able to catch the fish, it turned it over to another group.
And that's actually sort of a long-running story in salmon conservation efforts, is that there's so many different impacts from those four H's, from overfishing, from the habitat quality, and also ocean conditions in the marine environment that some years favor salmon and some years do not favor salmon, and so their fortunes rise and fall with the climate. It's very easy for one interest, once it comes to trying to craft solutions, to point at the other impacts and say, oh no, I'm not doing it, they're doing it, when in reality, it's a little bit of everybody.
Right. And that's basically the same situation as the Atlantic coast of the United States and Canada. Tell us about the whole process renewing itself. We saw what happened in England, didn't learn. Same thing happened on the Atlantic coast.
Same thing happened on the Atlantic coast. I was actually quite surprised to read some of the very early colonial descriptions of the super abundant salmon runs of New England from sort of Connecticut up through Canada.
From the Hudson River on, is that basically what the range was?
Yeah, although there's arguments over whether salmon were ever in the Hudson or whether it was the next river up, was it the Housatonic, or I'm not sure how to pronounce them, but virtually from the Hudson River, if not a little bit north, right on up into northern Canada.
And one tribe who actually had the totem of salmon. Salmon was their totem.
It was their totem. They adorned themselves, their canoes. It was their symbol. Much like the sort of the Sambler symbol of the Northwest. And yet you never hear about it. The cultural memory of super abundant salmon runs in New England is something that, having worked on salmon for almost a decade before I wrote this book, I didn't know it until I got into the background research and started reading stuff from these other areas and a lot of material that was 100, 200 years old. Some of the earliest laws in New England passed to protect salmon date back to 1709.
Right.
Which, yeah, that's been a while now.
Yeah, 300 years and still nothing. And so we talk about the Industrial Revolution. We talk about powering factories. We talk about using hydropower for that. And we talk about cutting down forests. In fact, you're saying that the forests now in the East have recovered somewhat to be, in some cases, better than the sort of checkerboard quilt that we have out here.
Growing up on the West Coast and living in the Northwest for a long time, I was literally shocked when I went back to give a lecture at Penn State, maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago now, and flew into there, and there was a continuous unbroken sea of forest cover on the areas surrounding the town. And I'm used to flying Seattle to San Francisco up and down the West Coast and looking at checkerboard forests. I was sitting there looking out the window going, this is more like what I've seen in the Amazon, in the still undeforested parts of the Amazon, than the western U.S. The eastern forests have, in terms of a closed canopy, have come back really well.
Yeah. So when we look at the main reason for the Atlantic salmon, wild salmon species to be decimated, are we talking?
It's the same set of 4-H's where there was a lot of dams were put in very early to power the Industrial Revolution in New England, transformed this country. It's not, not entirely a bad thing. But there was a trade-off that was never really acknowledged in a way that worked. You can trace concern over the effects of building dams and mill dams, clearing forests in New England back to the late 1700s. Mm. But the laws that were in place at the time were not very effective. They weren't very well enforced. And that's a theme that I think still runs through contemporary salmon recovery efforts, is that enforcement efforts are not necessarily prioritized or terribly effective. And literally salmon were blocked in one river slowly after another over time. And there's an effect. It's kind of like a ratchet effect that plays through this whole story as well, where we don't really remember the landscape from 100 years ago. We weren't alive. It's hard enough for me to remember the landscapes of my childhood in a way that isn't sort of embellished, if you will. And culturally, we tend to, I think, assume that the landscape we knew when we were young, it sort of is the baseline against which we measure change, but each generation has a new baseline, and so things ratchet down in terms of things like how many miles were actually open for salmon. There was always the good old days, but the good old days shifts with every generation in a way that, if you think like a geologist, over a few hundred years, you can take like the rivers of Maine, where after a couple hundred years of changes to the landscape, only 10% of the river miles that were originally inhabited by salmon, was it still even possible for salmon to get to from the ocean? And we're down in this region to 5-7% of the historic run sizes that we used to have. And I think it's actually really hard for us today to imagine what it was like when our rivers were that full of salmon.